You know, in that terrifying moment, the instant you realize someone you care about is just gone, panic sets in immediately. But then so does this whole system, right? Law enforcement kicks into gear.
Absolutely. And it's a system that reacts very differently depending on the situation.
Exactly. Is it a child? Is it an adult? Is it high risk? Is it maybe voluntary? All these factors change the response. But for most of us, it's kind of an opaque, you know, high-speed machine. We know they're looking, but how? What actually happens? What are the rules?
That idea of the opaque machine is spot on. And that's what we're here to do today, really, decode that system.
Right.
We've got a whole stack of source material here, actual legal codes, investigative procedures, that lays out the precise framework for how these cases, missing and exploited persons cases, are handled.
Right. So our mission is to get past the headlines, look under the hood, and give you real clarity on how this whole thing operates.
Yeah, the nuts and bolts.
The operational differences, the deadlines, some are incredibly fast, and the specific ways investigators categorize risk to, well, to throw every resource at the problem when needed.
And what's really fascinating, I think, is seeing how those legal definitions we're going to talk about, how they fundamentally drive the urgency. It's not just policy. It's baked into the law.
So the law dictates the speed.
Exactly. We're looking at mandatory mechanisms, systems built right into the code, designed to protect the most vulnerable by, frankly, removing discretion in those critical first moments and demanding speed. It's like a blueprint that shows the system understands time is everything.
Okay, so let's start at the foundation then, the language. Because in law enforcement, everything kicks off with a clear definition, right? What makes a missing child different from a missing person in the eyes of the law, beyond just their age?
Yeah, the distinction is crucial. And the Code of Criminal Procedure, the CCP, it's pretty clear about this, mainly to ensure that immediate resource-heavy action happens when it's absolutely necessary. So a child, super straightforward, is anyone under 18, full stop.
Okay. Under 18, automatically a child.
Right. A missing person, though, is defined as someone 18 or older whose disappearance is potentially not voluntary. That not voluntary part is key.
Okay. So for an adult, there needs to be some suggestion right off the bat that they didn't just walk away willingly or that they might be incapacitated somehow. It sets a different initial threshold compared to a minor.
Precisely. The law immediately flags minors for mandatory protection, whereas with adults, the circumstances surrounding the disappearance trigger that higher level of resource deployment.
Makes sense. And for a missing child, the definition goes deeper than just age, right? The source material listed specific situations.
It's very comprehensive, yeah. It covers the whole spectrum, not just, you know, the stereotypical stranger abduction. Mm-hmm. There are four main circumstances listed. First, the most obvious one, the involuntary taking. The child didn't leave willingly, and whoever took them wasn't authorized by law.
Okay, classic abduction scenario. But what about when the child does leave on their own?
That's the second category. The child voluntarily leaves home without the custodian's permission, and importantly, without intending to come back. So this covers runaways.
But there's still legally a missing child.
Absolutely. Right. Still triggers the full missing child protocol because they're minors and inherently vulnerable. The third and fourth points, they get into those tricky custodial fights.
Right, where it might be parent versus parent or parent versus guardian. That gets legally complicated fast.
It does. So the third circumstance is when a child is taken or kept in violation of a court order about possession or access. Think custody disputes. The fourth is similar. Keeping the child without the custodian's permission in a way that basically denies the custodian their rights.
Okay.
But, and this is a really important safety valve built into the law, that fourth rule, the deprivation one, it doesn't apply if the person kept the child because of family violence or attempted family violence against the child or themselves.
That's critical. So the system tries not to automatically criminalize a parent who's fleeing an abusive situation to protect their child. It looks at the reason behind the violation.
Exactly. It shows an attempt to account for real family safety dynamics, not just, you know, ticking procedural boxes. And beyond age, the definitions also broaden out to protect other vulnerable groups.
Right. I saw that. It's not just about being under 18.
Definitely not. The definition of missing child or missing person also covers people of any age who have a proven physical or mental disability or are senile. And because of that condition, they're in immediate danger or could be a danger to others.
So like an elderly person with Alzheimer's who wanders off gets the same immediate urgent response as a missing toddler.
Yes. Based purely on their vulnerability level. Or it could be someone whose safety is just in doubt because of the situation they're in or the company they're keeping, regardless of age or condition.
Okay. So before we get into the process of looking for them, who actually gets to pull the trigger on this? Who can file that report? The role of the legal custodian seems really central here.
It is. Because, like you said, if a child's in foster care or there's a complex custody order, the biological parent might not be the person with the legal right or responsibility to file that report at that moment.
Right.
So the system is designed pretty broadly. The legal custodian is the parent, unless someone else, like a managing conservator or guardian, has been appointed by a court. It could even be a possessory conservator or, you know, whoever had temporary legal care and control when the child vanished if they weren't living with a parent or guardian at the time.
So it's about who had responsibility then.
Exactly. It cuts through potential red tape. Whoever was legally in charge can make the report immediately. And there's also a legal presumption that if someone's name is on the birth certificate, they're presumed to be the parent for these purposes.
Okay. So, report filed by the right person. Where does all this urgent, detailed info go? That brings us to the nerve center for the state, right? The missing persons clearinghouse.
Yes, the clearinghouse. It's run by the Department of Public Safety, DPS. And it's absolutely foundational. It's not just a good idea to use it. The source material is crystal clear.
Yeah.
All state law enforcement agencies must use it. No exceptions.
Okay. Mandatory use. But why centralize it? Wouldn't it be faster sometimes for local police to just handle it themselves? What does this central hub do that, say, the local PD couldn't?
Good question. Centralization gives them really three key strategic advantages. First, it creates instant statewide communication. Everyone's plugged into the same system.
Okay, that makes sense.
Second, and this is huge for solving cases, especially older ones, it's the central file not just for missing kids and adults and attempted abductions, but also for information on unidentified dead bodies found anywhere in the state.
Whoa, okay, stop there. That connection, that's sobering, but absolutely necessary, isn't it?
It's heartbreakingly necessary, yeah. That cross-checking function, it's mandated by law, and it's often how long-term cold cases get resolved. A local department might find remains 300 miles away and have no idea it connects to a missing person report from years ago in another city. But the central database, it's constantly running those matches automatically. Local departments just can't replicate that efficiently.
Wow. Okay, so cross-referencing unidentified remains, what's the third function?
Third, the clearinghouse talks directly to the feds, the National Crime Information Center, or NCIC. So it links the state effort immediately into the national network. Plus, it runs the statewide toll-free phone line, you know, for the public to call in tips or report sightings. It's a critical public interface, too.
Okay, so that moves us into the procedures, the actual rules, and importantly, the deadlines that dictate just how fast things have to move. And the first point, maybe the biggest myth we need to bust, is about waiting periods.
Yes, let's be absolutely clear on this. There is no waiting period required to take a missing person report in this state. None. Zero. If law enforcement gets a report, they have to act. Immediately. End of story.
No, wait, 24 hours nonsense.
None of that. That's dangerous fiction.
Oh, wow, okay. And for kids, for missing children under 18, the law lays down deadlines that are, frankly, incredibly fast. Let's talk about that initial window.
Right. When a report comes in for a missing child, the agency must immediately start an investigation. But the really demanding part is the digital deadline. They have to get the child's name, all the identifying details, you know, dental records if available, fingerprints, what they were wearing, any suspect info entered into the clearinghouse, into NCIC, and into the Texas Law Enforcement Telecommunications System, TLETs.
Okay, three systems.
Three systems, immediately, but absolutely no later than 2 hours after getting that initial report.
2 hours. That seems incredibly tight for gathering and entering all that detailed data accurately. Why 2 hours? What's the strategic thinking there?
Because those first couple of hours are absolutely golden, especially in abduction cases. Getting that information into NCIC within 2 hours means it's searchable nationwide before an abductor has much chance to cross state lines.
Ah, okay. Beat them to the border, digitally speaking.
Exactly. And getting it into TLTS means it's searchable instantly by every officer on patrol within the state, maybe before they even cross county lines. It's about immediate, comprehensive digital saturation.
Okay, so that covers the state and national networks immediately. What about reaching out to nearby police departments directly?
That's the next deadline, the 48-hour network blast. Within 48 hours of getting the report, the agency has to electronically send the full report and all helpful identifying info to every single municipal and county law enforcement agency within 200 miles.
200 miles? That's a huge radius.
It is. It creates this wide overlapping net, pushing the info out to dozens, maybe hundreds of neighboring jurisdictions, anticipating that someone might try to lay low nearby or is moving rapidly within the region.
And then there's a longer-term requirement, focused more on those tragic cold cases.
Right. That connects back to the unidentified persons database we mentioned. For potential future matching, maybe years down the line, the child's name and info must be entered into the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. That's NAMUS. No, later than the 30th day after the report was filed.
Okay.
NAM is that critical federal resource for resolving those really tough, long-term cases. And importantly, the agency also has to tell the person who filed the report about all these steps being taken, keep them informed.
Okay, now here's a really strategic piece I saw in the sources. The special procedures, specifically for younger kids under 11, involving their school and birth records, it feels like using bureaucracy as a tripwire.
It's exactly that. It's a quiet, but potentially powerful layer of protection. If a child under 11 is reported missing, the law says law enforcement must immediately notify the child's school, any daycare facility they attend, and the state's Bureau of Vital Statistics.
And these places then have to do what? Just sit on the info?
They have to flag that child's records, put a digital marker on them.
So what happens if someone, maybe an abductor, like a non-custodial parent, tries to enroll that child in a new school somewhere else,
yeah,
or tries to get a copy of their birth certificate, maybe to get a fake ID or cross a border?
This is where the system gets clever. If someone makes a request in person for a flagged record, the school clerk or the vital stats office, they cannot tell the person, oh, this record is flagged. That would tip them off.
Right.
Instead, they have to play it cool. They ask the person to fill out a form name, address, phone number, relationship to the child, all the details. And they try to get a copy of the requester's photo ID. Then they immediately notify law enforcement about the request, giving them the requester's description, the ID info, everything.
Wow. So a routine paperwork request instantly becomes a hot lead for investigators. And the person making the request has no idea they just tripped an alarm. And then the system buys the police time.
That's the 21-day delay tactic.
Yeah.
After law enforcement is notified, the agency holding the record, the school or vital stats, waits. They mail the requested record to the person who asked for it, but only on or after the 21st day after the request was made.
3 weeks.
3 weeks. It gives law enforcement a critical window to investigate that lead, figure out who the requester is, determine if they're involved in the child's disappearance. All while the suspect thinks their request is just caught up in normal administrative delay.
Yeah.
It's a really smart, non-confrontational way to potentially intercept an abductor.
Yeah, it is clever. Using the system's own pace against the perpetrator, are there similar checks for just enrolling in school?
Yes. If a child under 11 enrolls in a new school district for the first time, the school has to get either a certified copy of their birth certificate or other proof of identity within 30 days. Or 90 days if the child was born outside the U.S. If the parent or guardian doesn't provide that required document within that 30-day window, the school must notify law enforcement. Law enforcement then has to check the clearinghouse to see if that child matches any missing persons reports. It helps catch situations where maybe an abductor destroyed the child's original papers.
So multiple bureaucratic tripwires. What about kids who are considered especially high risk? Maybe they've run away before or have known mental health issues. Does the response change?
It does. The law explicitly requires law enforcement to reasonably escalate the response for these kids. And within that same tight 2-hour initial window, they have to notify all law enforcement agencies within 100 miles, including across state lines, if relevant, specifically mentioning the high-risk designation.
Why the broader, faster notification for them?
Because the system recognizes that repeat runaways, or kids with significant mental health or intellectual disabilities, they face a much, much higher risk of being exploited or trafficked. The increased vulnerability demands a wider, faster net right from the start. So to manage all this, to make sure the right resources go to the right places with the right urgency, law enforcement uses these detailed categories. The entire investigation really follows the path set by which of these 8 types of missing persons the case fits into.
Okay, 8 types. Let's break those down. Starting with maybe the ones indicating the highest immediate vulnerability.
Right. First category, disability. This covers anyone, any age, with a physical, mental, intellectual, or developmental impairment that puts them at risk of immediate harm. Think about someone who's nonverbal or has cognitive issues where they can't easily communicate who they are or where they need to go. Their condition itself creates the risk.
Okay, that makes sense. The second one, endangered, sounds like it's more about the situation than the person's condition. How does that label change things?
Yeah, endangered is very circumstance-driven. It applies to a missing person of any age who is known to be in the company of someone else, or just in a situation where their safety is seriously in doubt.
So even if they went willingly initially, if the situation turns dangerous, they get flagged as endangered.
Exactly. And that label immediately bumps up the resource allocation. More officers, maybe specialized teams, wider search areas, compared to, say, a standard voluntary missing adult case. It prioritizes the current danger. Then the third category is involuntary. This confirms the disappearance definitely wasn't their choice. Pretty straightforward.
Okay. Then you have voluntary missing adult. Now, if someone's an adult and they left on your own free will, why did the police even take a report? What's the point?
That's the fourth type, and it's a good question. While adults generally have the right to disappear if they want, law enforcement still takes the report for a few key reasons. One, this category can include people who left with the intention of harming themselves, you know, suicidal intent.
Okay, a welfare check component.
Right. And even if not, taking the report gets them into the system. If that person later becomes incapacitated or gets into trouble, or is stopped by police in another state for something unrelated, that missing person flag provides crucial context for officers encountering them.
Gotcha. Okay, the next few categories seem linked to specific events or situations. Disaster victim.
Yeah, someone presumed missing because of a natural or man-made disaster, like a hurricane or a building collapse. Then juvenile, which is basically the category for a missing minor who doesn't fit into those higher risk buckets like disability or endangered or involuntary. A lower risk runaway might initially fall here.
And then missing from care. That one sounds like it carries a lot of inherent risk.
It really does. This covers adults missing from places like hospitals or nursing homes, but also, critically, children missing from agency placements, think foster care or group homes. The source material specifically highlights how vulnerable these individuals are.
Why specifically vulnerable?
Because they often lack stable support systems. They might have underlying issues like neglect, mental health challenges, instability. Being missing from care is almost like a flashing warning light for potential exploitation, trafficking, or simply injury because they don't have that safety net.
So the very fact they were in care makes their disappearance higher risk.
Absolutely. Predators know this. They target these situations. And finally, the last category is just other. It's the catch-all for cases that don't neatly fit the main criteria, but where there's still a reasonable concern for the person's safety. Or, interestingly, it also includes people under 21 who've been legally emancipated.
Okay, those are the types of missing persons. Now let's pivot to the circumstances of how they went missing. Abduction, runaway, wandering. The law makes distinctions within abduction, doesn't it?
It does. And it's important because while stranger abductions get all the media attention, they're actually quite rare. The most common type of child abduction, by far, is family abduction.
Taken by a parent or another relative, usually violating custody orders.
Exactly. And the really critical legal point here, according to the sources, is that even if the child wants to go with that non-custodial parent or relative, the act itself might still be illegal. It could fall under interference with child custody in the penal code.
So the law focuses on the violation of the court's decision about the child's best interests, not necessarily the child's immediate preference, which could be, you know, influenced or coerced.
Precisely. The legal system is trying to enforce the stability the court order was designed to provide. Then you have non-family abductions. These are carried out either by someone the child knows but isn't related to, like a neighbor, family, friend, maybe someone they met online, or in the rarest cases, by a complete stranger.
Okay. Now, let's talk about runaways. They're minors. They left voluntarily without permission. But this group seems incredibly vulnerable to ending up exploited. What drives kids to run?
Yeah, the vulnerability is huge. And kids don't run away for trivial reasons. The sources are really clear. Often, running away is a desperate coping mechanism. They're trying to escape a negative environment. Physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, severe neglect.
So running from something awful?
Usually, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mental health issues are also a major factor, so is substance abuse. And a big one is disruption in their living situation, especially for kids already in the child welfare system. They might run to avoid being placed in foster care, or because they're bounced between unstable placements.
A kid running from foster care or a group home, that sounds like an immediate pathway to extreme risk.
It's a huge red flag for exploitation risk. They're running away, they have no resources, no safe place to go, maybe deep distrust of authority figures. They're incredibly vulnerable, and predators actively seek out kids in exactly that situation. They're prime targets for traffickers. The sources also mention throwaway youth kids actually kicked out or told to leave by caregivers who are arguably at even higher risk immediately.
Just completely abandoned.
Yes. no safety net at all. Finally, the third circumstance, wandering. This is less about intent and more about cognitive or physical challenges, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Wandering is when someone who needs supervision because of age or condition leaves a safe place, like their home or a care facility. The danger comes from exposure, traffic, water hazards, weather, getting lost.
Yeah.
And law enforcement is trained to recognize different types of wandering.
Different types? Like what?
Well, there's goal-directed wandering. The person is actually trying to get somewhere specific, maybe a place they remember, like a park, or maybe they're drawn to water, or they're sensory-seeking. Then there's bolting fleeing. This is sudden, uncontrolled running, often triggered by stress, excitement, or sensory overload. It's really common in individuals with certain developmental disabilities, like autism.
That seems like it would need a totally different search strategy if someone just bolts.
Absolutely. They might be moving fast, might not respond to their name. The search has to be immediate and adapt to that specific behavior. The third type is just categorized as azert. This covers wandering due to general disorientation, maybe a mental health crisis, or conditions like dementia or Alzheimer's. Understanding these subtypes helps search teams predict, you know, where the person might be heading or why they left, which is vital when every minute counts.
Okay, so the internal investigation is running, the databases are updated, but then there are the public alerts, the ones that bring the whole community into the search almost instantly. But these aren't automatic, right? There have to be specific criteria met.
That's right. An alert is only effective if there's enough information to make it actionable. A good description of the person, maybe a vehicle, a suspect. Law enforcement has to decide if broadcasting an alert will actually help find the person, not just create panic or overload the system with vague information. There are six main alerts in the system, each designed for a specific type of high-risk situation.
Let's start with the big one, the Amber Alert. America's missing. Broadcast emergency response. Everyone knows the name, but what actually triggers a statewide Amber Alert?
The criteria are pretty strict, and they have to be. Generally, the child has to be 17 or younger. Law enforcement has to determine the disappearance was unwilling, so an abduction, not a runaway, and that the situation poses a credible threat to the child's safety and health.
Okay, unwilling abduction, credible threat.
Or there's a specific scenario for younger kids. If the child is 13 or younger and was taken without permission by someone who's unrelated and at least 3 years older, or if they were taken by a parent, but that parent committed or tried to commit murder around the time of the abduction. And crucially, police have to verify the abduction happened and rule out other explanations before they activate it statewide.
That verification step seems key to maintaining the alert's integrity. I noticed the source material mentioned something about local activation too, even if the statewide criteria aren't fully met yet.
Yeah, that's an important flexibility built in for speed. If the local police chief or sheriff strongly believes an alert is warranted, maybe they have solid evidence of an abduction, but they don't have the license plate yet, they can activate the alert just locally, within about a 100-mile radius or in adjacent counties.
So get eyes on the road nearby immediately.
Exactly. Get the public in the immediate vicinity looking during those critical first few hours, even while investigators are working to confirm details for a potential statewide alert.
Okay. What about alerts for vulnerable adults? There's the Silver Alert and the Endangered Missing Persons Alert. They both seem focused on cognitive issues.
They are, but with slight differences. The Silver Alert is primarily for locating missing seniors. Specifically, someone 65 or older reported missing within the last 72 hours. Or it can be for a person of any age who has a documented diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or a similar irreversible dementia or mental impairment, and their disappearance poses a threat to their own health and safety.
That 72-hour window for seniors is interesting. Why 72 hours?
It recognizes that for elderly individuals, especially those with cognitive decline, the risks from exposure, dehydration, or lack of medication can escalate incredibly quickly after they go missing. The 72 hours provides a reasonable time frame for reporting while still triggering an urgent response.
Okay. And the Endangered Missing Persons Alert, how's that different?
It's similar, but targets a different kind of cognitive vulnerability. This one is specifically for locating missing persons who have a diagnosed intellectual disability. Again, there must be a written diagnosis from a physician, they have to be reported missing within 72 hours, and their disappearance has to pose a credible threat to their health and safety because of that disability. The diagnosis requirement ensures it's used for those who genuinely may not be able to care for themselves or navigate safely.
Got it. So Silver for age-related or dementia-type cognitive decline, Endangered for diagnosed intellectual disabilities. What about other high-risk adults who don't fit those categories? That's where the clear alert comes in.
Exactly. The CLEAR Alert fills that gap. It's designed for missing adults between the ages of 18 and 64. They must have been missing for less than 72 hours. And this is key. They have to be in immediate danger of injury or death, or their disappearance has to be confirmed as involuntary. Think adult kidnapping victims, or someone who vanished under highly suspicious circumstances suggesting imminent harm, but who isn't elderly or doesn't have the specific diagnoses for the other alerts.
Okay, now the CAMEL alert. That one seems very specific to military members. Why a dedicated alert for them?
The CAMEL alert addresses a unique set of risks within the veteran and active military community. It's specifically for locating missing current or former members of the armed forces who have elected to participate in the program beforehand. They also must be suffering from a documented mental illness, like PTSD, or a traumatic brain injury, TBI, and their disappearance must pose a credible threat of harm to themselves or potentially to others.
So it acknowledges the specific mental health challenges, like PTSD and TBI, that can put veterans at higher risk, especially for self-harm.
Precisely. It leverages the public alert system and often the tight-knit military community itself to help find these individuals before a crisis escalates, recognizing their service and specific vulnerabilities.
Okay. And the last one, the blue alert, is different again, isn't it? It's not about finding a missing person.
Correct. The blue alert is purely a public safety and officer safety alert. It's activated when a suspect has killed or caused serious bodily injury, SBI, to a law enforcement officer, and that suspect is still at large and poses a serious ongoing risk to the public or to other officers. It uses the same broadcast technology as the other alerts, but its goal is apprehension of a dangerous suspect, not recovery of a victim.
Okay, so we've talked about finding people who are missing. Now let's shift focus a bit to identifying those who are being exploited, whether they were initially missing or not. The legal definition of exploitation is pretty broad.
How does the law define it?
It's defined as the illegal or improper use of a child, an elderly individual, or a disabled individual, or their resources, for someone else's monetary or personal benefit, profit, or gain. Wow, okay, that covers a lot of ground. Everything from, like, financial scams targeting seniors to much darker stuff.
Exactly. The sources break it down into several forms. There's sexual exploitation, which is abusing a position of power or trust for sexual purposes. There's labor exploitation, basically abusing people in a work situation for profit. There's financial exploitation, which is that unauthorized taking of money, assets, property, even identity, really common with elderly or disabled adults. And then there's online exploitation, things like sexual coercion, sextortion, often happening through social media or gaming platforms.
And the most severe form, the one often directly linked to missing persons cases, is human trafficking. What legally separates trafficking from these other forms of exploitation?
The core legal elements for trafficking are that it's involuntary and involves forced exploitation through specific actions. The term traffic, legally, means to transport, entice, recruit, harbor, provide, or obtain another person, using any means, with the intent to force them into labor or services, and then benefiting from that forced activity.
So force, fraud, or coercion is usually involved. And it's not just international, right? This happens domestically.
Absolutely. Big misconception. Trafficking happens everywhere, including within the U.S., sometimes even within the victim's own home or community. It's not always about crossing borders.
What are the main types of trafficking that law enforcement is looking for?
The sources highlight three main types. First, sex trafficking. And it's really important to note, the sources emphasize that a victim of sex trafficking is legally considered a victim of continuous sexual assault or rape. Second is child trafficking, which involves any commercial sexual exploitation of a minor or forcing a minor into labor. And third is labor trafficking. This is actually, according to the sources, the least recognized but potentially the most widespread form, both globally and here.
Labor trafficking, what does that look like?
It can take many forms. Forced labor in industries like agriculture, construction, restaurants, domestic servitude like nannies or housekeepers, held against their will factory work. It also includes things like bonded labor, where someone is forced to work off a supposed debt, or just involuntary servitude.
Okay. We talked earlier about certain groups being more vulnerable. Let's revisit that. Who are the populations most at risk for becoming victims of exploitation or trafficking?
While literally anyone can be a victim, the risk is definitely much higher for specific groups. Children are always high risk, but especially runaways, kids in the foster care system, or those involved in the juvenile justice system.
Makes sense. Who else?
The elderly and people with disabilities are frequent targets, especially for financial and labor exploitation. Non-citizens, particularly undocumented individuals, are vulnerable because traffickers exploit their fear of deportation. LGBTQ+ individuals, especially youth, often face higher rates of homelessness and discrimination, making them targets. People of color can face systemic factors that increase vulnerability. And anyone struggling with substance abuse or housing insecurity is also at significantly higher risk. Predators specifically look for these vulnerabilities.
They actively target people they think won't be missed or won't go to the police.
Exactly. Which brings us to interdiction. This is the term for law enforcement actively trying to intercept traffickers and victims, often during routine encounters like traffic stops or calls for service. How does an officer spot the signs, especially if the victim is scared or unwilling to talk?
Yeah, what are they trained to look for? It must be subtle sometimes.
It often is. Interdiction is about recognizing patterns and indicators, not jumping to conclusions. A big category is signs of control. For instance, restricted communication. Does the person seem coached? Are their answers scripted? Is someone else insisting on speaking for them, maybe translating, even if the victim seems to understand English?
Okay, controlling the narrative. What else?
Obvious signs of physical abuse, of course. But also look for extreme submissiveness, maybe avoiding eye contact, deference to the other person. Does the person seem free to move? Are they constantly escorted, even to the restroom? Do they know where they are or where they're supposedly going? Sometimes they have no idea about their own travel plans.
And the way IDs or phones are handled can be a big giveaway, right?
Huge red flag. Concealment of identification. Does one person hold all the IDs, passports, or money for everyone else? Does one person have multiple cell phones, maybe burner phones? That suggests control. Other indicators can be inconsistencies in their stories about travel or work, having few personal belongings, or maybe signs of branding or tattoos that indicate ownership by a trafficker.
Are there different signs officers look for to distinguish between, say, labor trafficking and sex trafficking?
Yes, there are some specific indicators, though they can overlap. For potential labor trafficking, officers might notice a stark power imbalance. Maybe one person, the potential trafficker, is well-dressed, driving a nice car, while the others look unkempt, maybe malnourished, dressed inappropriately for the weather. The manager might refuse to let the worker speak for themselves. There might be a big difference in luggage. The controller has nice bags. The potential victims have very little.
Okay. And for sex trafficking?
For sex trafficking, the indicators might involve items related to the commercial sex trade. Large amounts of cash with no clear explanation. Possession of bulk supplies of condoms or lubricant. Multiple cell phones or hotel keys. The person might use specific sexualized language or street slang associated with the trade. Often, there's an older person, maybe presenting as a boyfriend or guardian who does all the talking and seems to control the younger person, especially financially. Officers are trained to note all these details, the items, the language, the dynamic, the demeanor, as potential evidence.
Okay, let's move to the end of the process, hopefully the successful end, the recovery phase. Once a missing person is found, what are the immediate legal steps law enforcement has to take?
First things first, they have to clear the decks digitally. As soon as the person is confirmed recovered, the law enforcement agency must clear the missing person entry from the NCIC database. They also have to notify NANGBOS that the person has been located.
Why is that so critical?
It stops other agencies across the country from continuing to expend resources looking for someone who's already been found. It's a crucial administrative step to close the loop officially and accurately.
Makes sense. And when it's a child who's recovered, the reunification process seems very specific about who gets the child back, especially concerning custody.
It has to be. The officer's duty is to take possession of the child and deliver them to the person who is legally entitled to have possession at that time. Verification is paramount here.
Because the person calling might be a parent, but not necessarily the one with legal custody right then.
Exactly. And if the legally entitled person isn't immediately available to pick the child up, the law provides a mandatory failsafe. The officer must deliver the child to the Department of Family and Protective Services, DFPS.
So, to Child Protective Services.
Right. This ensures the child isn't handed over to someone without legal custody or potentially returned to an unsafe situation, just because they were the first person the police could reach. DFPS handles the verification and safe placement.
Now, when officers actually encounter the recovered person, especially if it's someone who's been trafficked or a runaway who's been through a lot, they probably don't always find someone relieved and ready to cooperate, do they? What should officers anticipate?
No, definitely not always. They need to be prepared for a wide range of reactions. The person might be completely disoriented, extremely tense or anxious, confused, maybe even combative or hostile. or they could be completely silent, shut down.
Physically, they might be in rough shape too.
Absolutely. Malnourished, dehydrated, injured, possibly under the influence of drugs or alcohol given to them by a trafficker. And crucially, officers need to understand that the victim may not see themselves as a victim.
How so?
They might willingly try to leave with the perpetrator again. They might lie to protect the abductor or trafficker, maybe out of fear, or sometimes out of a twisted sense of loyalty or dependency that's developed through grooming or trauma bonding. They might not even understand they were officially missing.
That reality sounds like it demands a very different approach than just standard police questioning. This is where that term trauma-informed care comes in. Why is that so important?
It's critical because trauma literally changes how the brain processes information, stores memory, and regulates emotions and behavior. Treating a victim like just another witness, or worse, a suspect, can re-traumatize them and shut down cooperation completely.
So what does a trauma-informed approach look like in practice?
The absolute priority is creating a sense of safety, physical, emotional, and psychological safety. This means things like immediately offering access to a victim advocate, avoiding handcuffs unless absolutely necessary for safety. For children, it means officers should physically get down on the child's level when talking to them, making themselves less intimidating. It's about reducing the power differential and building trust, however slowly.
Okay. And what if the person is really struggling to communicate? Maybe they're in shock or scared or have cognitive issues. The sources mentioned specific communication tactics, the TALK method.
Yes. TALK is a set of de-escalation techniques, often used with people experiencing dementia or significant mental distress. But the principles apply broadly to trauma victims who might be disoriented or overwhelmed.
Okay, let's break it down. T.
Take it slow. Be patient. Speak calmly. Use a normal, steady tone. Don't rush them. Speaking too fast or too loud can just increase their anxiety or confusion.
See.
Ask simple questions. Use very clear, literal language. Avoid complex sentences or questions with multiple parts. Someone whose brain is dealing with trauma might struggle to process complex information. And if they don't understand, repeat the question exactly the same way. Rephrasing can sometimes add to the confusion.
Mm-hmm.
Limit reality checks. This one is really important. Don't argue with them or try to correct their perception of reality right then, even if they're saying something clearly inaccurate, like where they think they are or who they think you are. Correcting them can feel invalidating, break trust, and make them defensive. If needed, gently redirect the conversation, but don't challenge their immediate reality. Keep eye contact. Use calm, steady, nonverbal communication, open body language, maintaining eye contact, if culturally appropriate and comfortable for them, to convey safety and trustworthiness. And officers have to remember, memory gaps, inconsistencies, contradictory statements, those are often symptoms of trauma, not proof of deception. They need to approach it with that understanding.
Okay. One last area. Disaster reunification. We touched on disaster victims earlier. Why is finding people after a huge disaster, like a hurricane or wildfire, so much more complicated than a typical missing person case?
Disasters throw a whole different set of massive challenges into the mix. First, just the sheer scale of the event can overwhelm systems. You have mass evacuations, people scattered to dozens of different shelters, often uncoordinated.
Infrastructure's down too, usually.
Exactly. Communication networks fail. No cell service, no internet. Roads might be impassable. There's often a lack of pre-established practice reunification plans for that specific type of disaster. And then you have huge barriers related to age and language. People with limited English, people who are deaf or hard of hearing, people who are nonverbal, they can easily get lost in the chaos of evacuation and struggle immensely to communicate their needs or find family members once they're outside their immediate community support system. #outro.
Wow. This has been a really intensive look at the mechanics of the system. We've gone from the foundational definitions that trigger everything to that critical 2-hour deadline for getting information into national databases, the different alert systems targeting specific risks, and maybe most importantly, the need for that compassionate, trauma-informed response when someone is finally found.
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway is how the entire system, legally and procedurally, is built around recognizing vulnerability and the absolute necessity of speed. All these mandated steps, the deadlines, the categories, it shows a deep understanding within the law that every single minute counts, especially in those initial hours. The goal isn't just finding the person. It's about preserving their safety, their dignity, especially for those most at risk of exploitation, right through the recovery process. It's a system really trying to protect the human element under the worst possible circumstances.
We talked about that really specific, almost bureaucratic rule flagging the school and birth records for missing kids under 11, creating that 21-day delay for requests. Think about that for a second. Just a simple flag in a file, a delay in paperwork, potentially stopping an abductor cold. It's such a quiet, clever piece of protection built into the administrative process itself. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? What other seemingly mundane, everyday bureaucratic steps hidden within the legal code or agency procedures might be acting right now as silent guardians, those unnoticed little rules that are quietly saving lives without anyone ever knowing? That's something to think about as we wrap up this deep dive.